History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it before we run out of time. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And isn't it something how when we start down that road, we don't only end up educated or entertained, but also inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. 100-year-old Leon G. of Sanger, California is our guest today. He served in World War II aboard the battleship USS South Dakota. He even makes regular pilgrimages to Sioux Falls and the battleship South Dakota Memorial. But we always see the war in greater context when we rewind the tape and go back to the beginning. Born in Missouri, like so many people in that part of the country, come to California during the Great Depression. What are your earliest memories of childhood? What are some of the things that, when you think back on those early years, stand out for you?
When we came to California, the first place we came to was Taft, California. My father was a minister, and we didn't stay in Taft long. Some people there knew people in Clovis, and there was a church opening up there, so we came to Clovis. Living in Clovis is one of the earliest things that I remember that. And
I've got a lot of friends who are preacher's kids, PKs. Some of them really love it. Some of them had a hard time with it. Where did you fit in on that spectrum?
Well, it was kind of hard, really, because, I don't know, they call them holy rollers. And It was kind of rough going being a preacher's kid, really.
So you probably had to be in church every Sunday, huh?
We did, and usually Wednesday night, too, Sundays and Wednesdays.
And do you remember, as a boy, having some ideas, hey, when I grow up, I'm going to do X, Y, Z, or this is what I'm going to be?
No. What I remember, what we used to have to do was pick grapes to make raisins and whatnot. And I said, well, when I grow up, one thing I'm going to do is not pick grapes, because I'm going to move to somewhere where they don't have grapes.
Sounds like that was pretty hard work for a kid, huh?
Well, yeah, it was hot. You didn't get a lot of pay, either, about a cent and a half a tray for picking grapes.
And, you know, kids today, most of them have a smartphone. They've got the shoes they want. They might be driving the car they want. For those of us who didn't experience the Depression years, can you give us a taste of what life was like? What you actually had, what you didn't have?
Well, we had very little. Every year, my dad would take us back to Missouri where we came from. And I remember back then, it was about 1,500 miles from Sanger to Mount Vernon. You'd pass a car or something, and then a while later, maybe we stopped and got gas, and they'd pass us, and then pretty soon we'd pass them again back and forth on the way back there.
You had a big family. You're one of eight children in the family. How about food? Did you guys always have enough food?
Yeah, fourth, I know. Wherever we lived, my dad always had a cow or something, so we had our own milk, and we had plenty to eat.
And how about Sanger before World War II? What kind of place was that? What might stand out about Sanger before the war?
Sanger had a lot of packing houses. They had probably seven or eight packing houses down the academy. And now there's no packing houses in Sanger at all. The ice company used to furnish all the freight cars back then. They used to ice the bunkers on the end of the freight cars for refrigeration for when they shipped the grapes. Now then they have a mechanical diesel engine for the refrigeration now.
And it sounds like other than your time in the Navy in World War II, you never did end up somewhere where they don't grow grapes, huh?
No. I had, like I said, I had the business in Sanger Academy Manufacturing Machine Works. My brother was married and had two boys, and we couldn't make enough money back then for him to work, so he went to work for a company in Sanger called General Nailing Machine. And what General Nailing Machine did was they made the wooden boxes and things for shipping the grapes in.
And I'm guessing just about everyone that I've talked to who was alive on December 7th, 1941, has some kind of memory about that day. Do you remember anything about that Sunday morning? Oops, about that Sunday morning?
Yes. That Sunday morning, my brother got married, and my uncle, Bert G., was a minister also, and my brother got married in our house in Sanger there at that time. I remember that.
That's kind of some tough news to interrupt a wedding reception.
We went to church, but we never knew that the Japanese had bombed it till after we got out of church that Sunday morning.
And, you know, now we've all heard the story, we've all heard Roosevelt's speech and all that, but how big of a shock was that at the time for a 16-year-old kid to hear, hey, America's been attacked?
No, I didn't think too much about it. I'm too young to really realize what was actually happening.
Were they talking about it at school the next day? Did they have you listen to the president or anything?
No, I don't remember him saying anything at school.
How long did it take before you started to realize, hey, this war may involve me?
Well, that's when, like I said, I tried to join. I couldn't join, but I was drafted. So they put me on a bus in Fresno, and the bus went to San Francisco to the federal building, and that's where I was sworn into the Navy. I got on a train and went to Spokane, and from Spokane I got on a bus and went to built a new training station in Farragut, Idaho for the Navy, and that's where I went and started my career in the Navy.
I want to take you back a little bit. When you told me part of your story before, I wasn't recording yet. So when my grandfather tried to go in the Army before Pearl Harbor, they told him he was too fat and had to lose weight. Sounds like the Navy had the opposite problem with you. What did they tell you when you first tried to sign up?
Well, they told me to go home and put some weight on and come back, and maybe we'll take you. But like I said, in the meantime, I was drafted.
So the urgency changed. So they take you all the way to this place, Farragut, Idaho. What time of year was that?
I think it's in June or July. It's in the summertime, and it's pretty hot.
Because I've talked to some guys who were there in the winter, and that was not a pleasant experience either. What kind of stuff did they do with you?
After we got out of boot camp, I told them I wanted to be a machinist mate because that's what I was going to do when I got out of the Navy. And they told me, now we got all the machinist mates we need. You're going to be a radarman. And I said, well, I don't know what radar was. Never heard of it.
You're saying it wasn't on your radar?
No.
Sorry, I couldn't resist. So was that hard to learn something that was so foreign to you?
No, it was really good. I think that happened is the best thing I could have done because I really enjoyed that duty aboard ship.
How about the physical part of that? Did they put you guys through the ringer trying to whip you into shape?
Yeah, they did that and taught us how to put a gas mask on and run us through a tear gas chamber. and we went to the rifle range, and I was familiar with guns and everything because I'd hunted with my dad and everything, and found out later looking at when I got discharged that I was classified as a expert rifleman.
Just didn't get to use that skill too much aboard ship, huh?
No. No, the duty in CIC was super, though. You know, aboard ship, there are about 1,500 people or something, and you only, like living in a small town, you only knew the people that you worked with or were around you all the time. That's the only one you really knew aboard ship.
I'm curious, too, because some guys have told me, you know, when they're finishing up their training, they wanted to be on an aircraft carrier. Some guys were crazy enough, they wanted to be on a destroyer, or they even volunteered to go on submarines. Did you have an idea of what kind of ship you preferred?
No, I just, when I got out of boot camp, they just sent me to Bremerton, Washington, and the South Dakota was there being repaired from some damage they had gotten before, and that's where I got aboard the South Dakota.
Well, that's pretty encouraging, isn't it? The ship you're going on is getting repaired because the enemy put some pretty good dents in it?
Yes. That's pretty neat. But when the ship left Bremerton, when we stopped at Pearl Harbor, I really liked that because I had an uncle lived in Pearl Harbor. He went there in 1939 working for General Motors. So he was there when... And he was in charge of the paint shop there, so every time we stopped there, I enjoyed being with my uncle.
Well, I just have to ask, in the times that you spent with him, did he ever tell you about his experience on December 7th?
No, I never talked to him about that.
You know, now people go there, and it's quite the tourist spot. You can go out to the Arizona and see the tiers of oil coming up and see all the names on the wall. What about back then, while the war was still going on? What could you see in the harbor?
No, well, back then, when you went to Hawaii, the only hotel on the thing was the Royal Hawaiian Hotel. There's only one hotel there then, and a lot of pineapple fields between the Navy base and back into town.
And you mentioned the CIC, so a lot of sailors know what that is. Other folks may not. Can you explain what that stands for and what that meant for you?
Yeah, CIC is Combat Information Center, and that's where the air search radar and the surface search radar consoles were, where we operated it. And you could hear all the radio conversations between all the other ships. And the task group, usually the ship, usually about 20 destroyers, maybe a cruiser, maybe two battleships, or maybe sometimes one. They was called task group. They switched names, 38 and 58 task groups, and they did that. It was the same ship, but they did that to confuse the Japanese and make them think we had twice as many ships as we had. But being in CIC, whenever on the radar, sometimes we'd pick up the Japanese send out about 300 or 400 planes at a time. We could hear the other aircraft carriers and things launching planes to intercept them. And you could hear when the airplanes would shoot one down, you'd say, hear them say, splash one, bogey or something. On the radar, the way you could tell whether they were friendly or enemy, we had what on the radar antenna, you pointed towards the Japanese airplanes, and we had what they called IFF, information friend or foe. And the way you could tell was friend or foe, we had a transmitter on that, and it'd send a signal to the planes, and the planes had a transponder and send the signal back, and it'd be a coded signal, so you could tell whether it was a friendly aircraft or enemy aircraft. And they changed that code maybe even once during the day or something, or to make sure that the Japanese hadn't figured out the code.
So you're there in the CIC, and you're watching a display, but then you have to react based on what you see. So if you see Japanese planes on that radar, what are you supposed to do?
Well, I can remember this, that we were operating with the aircraft carrier Ticonderoga, And all the ships had code names. I can remember the Ticonderoga was Brownie. They'd call Brownie and say, "We show Japanese airplanes, give them the bearing and range. Do you confirm?" And they answer back, "Yeah, they confirm that we see those and we're intercepting them."
You know, so many of the guys that I've talked to, there seems to be one moment that made everything real, that kind of made the gravity of the situation something you could feel. Was there kind of a welcome to the war moment for you where the intensity and the seriousness of what you were doing hit home?
No, I don't think I really thought too much about that at the time.
Did you ever wonder if you were going to make it home?
No, I never feared that I wasn't going to make it home.
Why not?
I don't know. Because my mother and dad, I know they were saying a prayer for me to keep me safe.
Those prayers were answered, and Leon G is going strong at age 100. I saw him at every single home basketball game this year for the Fresno State Bulldogs. He's been going to those games since the 1950s. In fact, he was there at the L.A. Coliseum to witness the culmination of that school's last perfect season in football in 1961. Riding to the Mercy Bowl on a Rooter bus on which a former Fresno State star turned TV personality named Al Radka entertained the fans along the way. So many memories, but we're going to go back to World War II and the battleship South Dakota when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 100-year-old Leon G. of Sanger, California. When he moved to the Golden State, Clovis was a city his family called home for a while, and that's where this interview was recorded. Amidst the impressive World War II display at the Free Admission Clovis Veterans Memorial District Heritage Center Museum. Back in 1944 and 1945, Leon was a radar man aboard the battleship USS South Dakota. So your ship earned 13 battle stars in the war. You told me you were aboard ship for the last 7 of them. So I know you saw a few things and experienced a few things. What are some of the intense moments that you remember?
I don't think I had anything that had an intense moment. I don't think that I can remember.
Well, your ship had a few, right? Fired a lot of shells and had quite a few fired in your direction. So you guys bombarded for the last 2 major battles in the Pacific, Iwo Jima and Okinawa. And when Okinawa came around, it's pretty infamous for the amount of kamikazes that were flying around. Was there concern, a fear, that your ship may be targeted by a suicide attack?
No. One thing I can remember is when we knew that our planes were intercepting those and what they shot down, we knew that when they got Japanese planes got closer to all the ships in our task force, you could hear our 5-inch guns start firing at the planes. They were hoping to hit one of the planes with the 5-inch shell. The shells would explode and the shrapnel would hit the other planes around there. As the Japanese planes got closer, we had 40 millimeter aircraft guns, and we, when you heard them start firing, you knew the Japanese were getting closer. And then when the 20 millimeter and the 50 caliber machine guns started firing, you know they were really close then. And then when all the firing stopped, you knew they'd either all got shot down or one of the kamikazes had crashed into somebody, one of the ships.
And you describe that like it's one of those Fresno State basketball games you go to all the time or something. No big deal. But I'm thinking, you know, they're getting closer, they're getting closer, they're getting closer. There's a gentleman in Santa Cruz who's 104. He was on the New Mexico in the CIC, and they took a direct hit to the CIC, the same spot that you were on your battleship, the South Dakota. So I know you were in a position that could be in a lot of danger, but you weren't nervous? You weren't scared?
Well, no. They probably, maybe on that ship, they didn't, but they moved the CIC three decks down. And on top of the third deck, the armor plate was 3-inch thick steel. So you were down below that, and you were pretty sure that you weren't going to be hit aboard ship.
And that was probably a move predicated by some of the previous attacks, where a CIC that was up with more of a visual perspective had been hit. So you were protected by all that metal plating. You felt pretty secure.
Yeah, I thought we were secure. I didn't ever worry about being hurt aboard ship.
But you probably became aware of things that happened to other ships or even guys like you. How hard was that to process some of the casualties that were taking place?
No, some of the things that remember aboard ship, one time when we were taking on ammunition, one of the gunpowder for the 16-inch guns come in a metal container, but the static electricity set off one of those containers and fortunate enough, it wasn't down in the magazine. It's still up on the main deck. It killed about 9 people, I think, and burnt some of the other ones. And another thing that I remember all the time is, I'm not an emotional person, but sometimes when I think about it, is a burial at sea, when we buried those people at sea.
I know it's a big crew on a battleship. Did you know any of those guys who were killed?
No, only one I knew was in the I Division, which was the radar division. There's about 70 of us. That's really the only ones I knew aboard ship.
You mentioned that burial at sea, and maybe folks have seen pictures or they've seen some old film, but can you describe what takes place in a burial at sea and what that was like for you to be standing there witnessing it?
Well, whether they were Protestants or Catholics, I used to go to all of the burials at sea, even though I didn't know the person or anything. I guess because my dad was a minister, the reason I went.
Mm-hmm. Is there part of you that says, that could have been me?
No. Well, they sewed them up in a canvas thing, put a 5-inch shell that weighed 35 pounds between their legs, and then one of the mess tables, they had them laying on that. They'd just tip it up and it'd slide off into the sea.
And I'm not trying to be melodramatic, but that gunpowder could have gone off by you. That could have been you that never comes home. I'm just wondering, what's that like to be a young sailor watching somebody just like you that is the ending for? What kind of emotions that stirs in you?
I often wonder if they took the coordinates and gave it to the survivors or not, whether survivors would know where they were buried.
And you said something, too, about that incident with the gunpowder, that it was a good thing it didn't go off in the magazine. Because what you're saying is then there would be a chain reaction explosion and it wouldn't be just 9 guys who were killed.
Yeah. That would have been the end of the South Dakota if it had been in the magazine.
Would have sunk the ship.
Yeah, it definitely would.
Were there some close calls that your ship had during your time aboard her?
No, not after I got aboard. Before, they were.
You know, you mentioned the different levels of protection and how much closer the enemy was in terms of the 5-inch guns all the way down to the anti-aircraft. What does it feel like on a battleship when those 5-inch guns are going off?
No, you just don't want to be outside close to where they are because they make a lot of noise. And one time when they were firing the 16-inch guns, I was wanting to be outside. Well, that was a mistake because this loud thing that putting your hands over your ears didn't do any good. You had to get behind the turret or something where they were firing for it didn't bother you.
I imagine the ship shakes a little bit, too.
Yeah, a little bit, but not that bad.
So many guys who spent time in the Pacific during those years have said, yeah, you know, the naval engagements were one thing, bombarding an island, kamikazes, but the worst thing I remember is a typhoon. Did you ever have to deal with some rough weather at sea?
Yeah, we went through Typhoon Cobra.
The most infamous one of all?
Yeah, I don't know. And that's really a rough ride, I tell you. No way explaining it, and you'd have to be on it, know what it's like.
Well, I'm going to try to get a little more out of you. We had a guy here locally who was on one of those destroyers that sank in Typhoon Cobra, the hull. So tell me what you experienced in this most devastating typhoon that really changed the way the Navy did a lot of things afterwards.
One of the things that I remember was is I kind of got seasick when we went through the typhoon. I can remember how rough it was. One thing I could remember when you was going up the ladder or whatever, if the ship was going down and you were going up, you could fly up that ladder. But when it was the other way around, it was really hard to climb up the ladder. There's just no way of explaining what it feels like. You'd have to be on the ship to know what it's like. I can just imagine what it's like being on a destroyer because the South Dakota, the bow would go underwater far enough the water would come clear up over the number two turret. Just a rough ride.
Did you have to tie yourself down to anything?
No. You could still get around pretty good. Nobody, of course, was on outside. Everybody had to stay inside during that.
Well, and I'm thinking about that too. You told me you weren't worried about not coming home because you knew your mom and dad were back home praying for you. Were there ever situations, maybe the typhoon could have been one of them, where you found yourself saying that kind of prayer?
Yeah, I think so.
What would have brought you to that point? What can you give us a feel for what kind of situation motivates you to do that?
I really didn't think that the South Dakota would ever sink or anything. We just ride it out and go on.
I know you guys were there bombarding Iwo Jima. What everyone talks about now with Iwo Jima, of course, is the flag going up on Mount Suribachi. I know you've been to the Marine Corps Memorial where it's depicted in that great giant bronze statue. But did you ever get to see a flag flying on top of that mountain?
No, we were never close enough to see that. When we were bombarding the range, I think, of the 16-inch guns is about 12 miles, so we were quite a ways offshore when we were bombarding.
And that's another thing that comes to mind. So you know how long you guys bombarded, and you weren't the only ship bombarding. When you heard about what actually happened there, and how little all that bombardment affected the enemy, did that kind of blow your mind a little bit?
No, we never heard how good a job we'd done or anything.
Well, they were all underground in those tunnels and everything, and they still had some pretty good strength. As the war went on, did you get an inkling beforehand that maybe it was close to getting over?
No, not until towards the the end of the war, we were at the northern island of Japan, Hokkaido, and we were shelling steel mill up there, and along with some other battleships who were selling, and the 5-inch guns were hitting some smaller targets and whatnot, and then that's when we heard they dropped the A-bomb. We still was shelling targets and everything, and then when after we heard they dropped the second one, and we heard that the Japanese had surrendered, that was a joyful day.
Yeah. Was there a little celebration on the South Dakota?
Yeah. Yeah, everybody's pretty happy.
That's when the supply of beer dwindles pretty quickly, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, you didn't get any beer aboard ship. The only time you got any beer was when you'd go ashore. We used to go in to Ulysses Islands, to a little island called Mog Mog. They'd let you go ashore to have rest and recreation, and they'd give you 2 cans of beer. I didn't drink beer, so I'd give mine some of the buddies that wanted it. And I remember the name of the beer was Schaefer. Huh. I can remember that. We used to go ashore and play some basketball or baseball. I used to go swimming, and I like to look at the colorful little tropical fish and stuff, and that's what I did most time when I went ashore. And then if you didn't have liberty to go ashore, they'd let us swim off the side of the ship.
Yeah, I guess I didn't ask you about that. You said you pretty much only knew the 70 guys in your division. But how'd you get along with those guys?
They were super guys, and I stayed in contact with all of them after I got out of the service until they passed away. I'm the only one left that I know of that's still living.
I was going to ask you about that. So you got to go to some ship's reunions over the years?
Yeah, I go about every year. The second weekend in August, I'll be going again this year if I'm still able.
Even though you're the only one. So when you go, you'll have the sons and daughters of other sailors?
Last year there was 2 of us there. Years before, I would be the only one there, but I don't know if I'm the only one that I know of that's still living.
It's time for our final break, but when we come back, where Leon G. was on the day World War II officially came to an end, and more from this centenarian about the memorial for his ship that you may want to visit yourself. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Coming down the home stretch with Leon G., 100 years old, of Sanger, California. He served aboard the battleship USS South Dakota in World War II. You heard him share a little bit about ship's reunions, which have really enriched his later years. And you may enjoy visiting the site of those reunions yourself.
In Sioux Falls, South Dakota, they have the battleship South Dakota has a memorial there, like I said, that has a lot of the stuff aboard ship. They have the captain's silverware, and they have a ship's bell, and they have one of the 16-inch gun barrels, and one of the ship's masts that has one of the surface radar antennas on it that I used to operate. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, they have. When we were in Tokyo Bay after the war, some of the sailors on the South Dakota went aboard the Japanese battleship and took down the Japanese flag off the ship, and it's in the memorial back there in Sioux Falls.
Were you guys in Tokyo Bay on September 2nd?
Yeah, the South Dakota led the fleet into Tokyo Bay. We dropped anchor there. And, of course, you know the surrender was signed on the Missouri. But when we first went into Tokyo Bay, Admiral Nimitz flew in on a seaplane, came aboard South Dakota. Admiral Halsey come in on a seaplane, came aboard ship. So we assumed that the surrender was going to be on the South Dakota. But since our president, Mr. Harry Truman, was from Missouri, so that's the reason it was signed on the Missouri.
I'm just curious, is it a big deal for guys like you and other sailors when someone like Admiral Nimitz or Admiral Halsey comes aboard?
No, I seen them when they come aboard, but that's all. I was never close enough to them or anything.
And when you go to Sioux Falls and you see all those remnants of your ship, what does it do for you? What kind of feelings or emotions does that stir?
It makes me think back to being aboard ship. And since we've been going there, I've made a lot of friends back there and everything. And on the internet, if anybody's interested, you can do a Google search and find and see things. They have things that you can buy. They have a DVD about the South Dakota that you can buy, and they have a lot of apparel, South Dakota apparel that you can get.
And have you been out to the Missouri at Pearl Harbor?
No. The sister ships to the South Dakota, the Alabama, is in Mobile, Alabama. Mm-hmm. I've been aboard it. And the Massachusetts is in Falls River, Massachusetts. And I've been up there aboard it. And I've seen on the internet that they let you come and sleep the night sometimes on that, to see how the sailors used to sleep aboard that ship. I think that would be interesting.
You saying you'd be up for sleeping like that again?
No, not really.
Well, I guess I have to ask you, why not? Tell us what those sleeping conditions were like on the South Dakota.
Where I slept, the bunks were four high. And I slept in the top bunk because I didn't like people climbing over mine to get up there and get into bed.
How about after the surrender? So September 2nd, 1945, they're all on the Missouri signing the surrender. The war is officially over. Was the war over for you yet, or did the Navy have a few more things for you to do?
No, it's over. Left there, we stopped by Guam and picked up about 1,500 Marines and soldiers. And people say, well, where'd all of them sleep? And I said, any place they could find to lay down, because they were headed home and they weren't worried about where they slept. And then we stopped by Pearl Harbor on the way home. And then, of course, we sailed into San Francisco under the Golden Gate Bridge to a welcome and home deal.
They were cheering for you?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of people on the bridge and everything when we sailed under the bridge.
How did that make you feel?
I felt all right. I was glad to be back home. And then when the ship left there, we went back down to Long Beach to the anchor by San Pedro in Long Beach. And we stayed there for quite a while. And, of course, I could go home on a weekend if I had a weekend pass from Long Beach. And one time when I didn't have Liberty, this buddy of mine aboard ship, Raymond Shelto, He said, well, why don't you take my Liberty and go home? I said, okay. He said, you wasn't gone but about an hour till they come looking for you. And they said, well, I'm going to save his duty. What does he have to do? They said, well, pack your things. You're going to be transferred to the battleship Iowa. So when I come back, I never thought about not seeing him anymore. But after a long time, we came, when I used to travel in my motorhome, I said, boss, stop by and see Ray. And I stopped by and see Ray, and he told me about that, and I didn't know anything about that.
So you got him in big trouble.
Yeah.
What was it like to get back home to Sanger after everything you've seen and everything you've been through to see your family again?
Well, okay, but after when we left Long Beach, the battleship South Dakota went down through the Panama Canal, mm-hmm. and we went up to the West Coast to Philadelphia. And at Philadelphia, that's where I got off the battleship South Dakota. Me and my buddy Presti Giacomo got on a train. We went to Chicago, and then from Chicago, we rode the train to California. And the train that we rode, the seats wasn't cushioned seats or anything. Seats were like school bus seats or something. and we had to lay down on the bench with the seat until we got, it took about 3 or 4 days to get to California. After that, we went to Shoemaker, and that's up by Livingston. Shoemaker is a Navy receiving station, and there they sent me to Treasure Island. And at Treasure Island, I got on an ATR-51, was a seagoing tugboat. And it's a steam-powered tugboat built in Stockton, California. And got on that tugboat, and it was going to go to the East Coast again. And before we got down to close to San Pedro or Long Beach, it broke down, and it didn't have any auxiliary communication radios or anything, and we're about to drift into some fishermen's nets. And the fishermen, Holland told them to call the Coast Guard to send the tugboat out to tow us into bay. So they towed us into San Pedro. And while it was in San Pedro, I got enough points to be discharged. So that's where I got out of the Navy.
Do you remember the look on your parents' faces when you came home?
No, No, I don't remember. Uh-huh. I don't even know how I got a hold of them to come and get me. Back then, you didn't have communication like now. I don't know if I found a phone somewhere to call them or what. I don't remember.
But they picked you up. Good thing. Was it hard to get used to civilian life after spending that time in the Navy?
No. That was it. When I came home, that's when me and my brother started this business in Sanger. Mm-hmm. And like I said, couldn't make enough money for us, so he went to work for General Nailing. But that's where I operated the business until I retired.
Well, and there might be a few people listening who you did business with over the years. What kind of stuff did you do? What was the core of your business?
We didn't manufacture a product. People bring a set of drawings to us, and we'd manufacture what they wanted. And we did a lot of repair service for, there was two frozen food plants in Sanger called Glacier's, and Frosted Fruits, and I did a lot of work for them and a lot of work for farmers and other people around. Mm-hmm. And I did manufacture some things for an ice company in Fresno and some things like that. There's a company called Atmospherics Incorporated, and what they did is they seeded clouds to increase the rainfall and everything. Mm-hmm. They did for the Kings River Conservation District and everything. I did a lot of manufactured a lot of cloud seeding equipment and stuff.
So you're a guy who can make it rain.
Yeah. They make it increase rain, and they also did hail suppression, where they would seed the clouds to stop the hail.
One thing I forgot to ask you about was the Honor Flight. I know it's been a few years since you went to Washington, D.C. I'm curious to know what it's like for you when you see that wall of gold stars and you know that's 406,000 guys like you who didn't get to come home from the war. What does that bring to mind for you? What do you think of when you consider that display or that number, 400,000 who died in World War II?
I can imagine what it's like for the parents of those and everything that didn't come back. And it must have been awful difficult for them.
And you're 100 years old now. 100 years is a lot to think about, a lot of memories, a lot of experiences. But when you think back over a century, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
No, I'm thankful for every morning when I wake up again that I get another day.
Uh-huh. And is there anything you haven't done in 100 years that's still on your list that you're hoping to have a chance to do sometime?
No, not I can think of. I just hope I'm able to go back to Sioux Falls again in August to the Morro once more.
I imagine they treat you pretty well when you show up there.
Yeah. They give me a party, bought a big cake and everything to serve everybody back there for my 100th birthday. And every year when we go back there, they have a program where sometimes they have the governor there to speak or different speakers every time. Mm-hmm. And that's quite a deal, really.
Well, and what I guess I have to ask, you know, there are a lot of people, myself included, who would love to make it to 100. So what kind of advice do you have for us? What's your secret to being this with it at 100 years old?
Well, I don't never drink or smoke or do anything. I think that has something to do with longevity.
So you mentioned your daughter Linda went with you on the honor flight, but she said she didn't even know you were in the war till she was in her 30s. Was there a reason you were reluctant to open that part of your life up to people?
No, I just never thought about they'd be interested.
Well, and on that note, you know, a lot of people are interested, and a lot of young people are interested now. People that are the same age you were when you were going around the Pacific. What do you think is the most important thing for people to know today about what you and 16 million Americans in uniform did in World War II?
I don't know. Just to know that we served our country well.
And we still have a country because of it.
Yeah.
What do you think about when you see the flag?
I think about what a great country we have.
Leon G., 100 years old. I mentioned his 70-plus years of going to Fresno State Bulldog games. He and his wife, Marion, had dates there even before they got married. And their daughter, Linda, jokes that she's been attending those games since she was in the womb. But for many years, Linda had no idea her father had served in the Navy.
Did not know he was a World War II veteran until I was about the age of 30, when my son was about 2 years old. And then he was talking, I guess they were talking to my husband, and my husband came home and told me, hey, I didn't know your dad was on the ship of South Dakota. And I said, neither did I. And so that's how the conversation started, because he retired the year my son was born, and they started traveling, and that's how they found out about the reunion. And they started going back to the reunion ever since. When they started going to that reunion, I think there was like 500-600 people, and now it's down to just him. So it's kind of cool, you know, understanding history now more than I did when I was a kid, because I used to hate anything to do with history. And now that I see the connection, it makes a lot more sense. It makes a lot more interesting to me to find out. But he always tells me, ask him questions, and I'm like, I don't know what to ask.
Has it changed? Is that journey of, you know, going to reunions, going to the World War II Memorial, the Navy Memorial, all these other places, has it changed your perspective on who your dad is?
Because I feel that his generation is the last greatest generation that's around, you know, because without them, we wouldn't be living in the country we live in. And I think people forget about that a lot, that they don't realize what history before has created where we are now. And I think it's sad that kids, I mean, I taught for 36 years. I'm sad that kids don't really understand the true meaning of freedom and the true meaning of what would be their grandparents gone through to get to where we are today. Well, he just was the greatest dad ever.
What better way to wrap up the program than with a statement like that? If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, you'll find photos of Leon and his family, and also a link to the Battleship South Dakota Memorial in Sioux Falls. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.